Okay, welcome everybody to the Iran Brooks Show. And today we're doing our Patreon hangouts and open Q&A. So get ready with those, the super chat on YouTube. We'll be taking questions on anything today. Also, if you contribute more than $25 on Patreon, you should have gotten a phone number you can call in to ask questions. And we'll see if there are not enough Patreon questions. I might just give you the phone number on Block Talk Radio. I might take even some phone calls. So we can do that. I'm open to questions. Let's see. We've got YouTube is working. Facebook is working. I think Block Talk Radio is working. And Jonathan and Jennifer are here. We're supposed to have Upton as well, but maybe he'll show up in a little while. So the floor is yours, Jennifer and Jonathan. You guys get first dibs on any questions you want to talk about, any issues you want to raise. Hopefully you came prepared, did your homework. Yeah, Jonathan.
I wanted to pick up your own with something.
Speak up a little bit, though.
Sure. I wanted to quickly ask about something that you and Amy had started talking about, which was the issue about transgender.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Well, it's an interesting one. I know Dr. Peikoff had a lot to say about it, so I thought if you would elaborate a bit on what you started to speak about.
All right. So yesterday, for those of you who haven't seen the show yet, you probably should. I thought it was a good show with Amy yesterday. So it's up on YouTube and Facebook and on Blog Talk. We talked about this pharmacist at CVS who refused to give a transgender, I guess she was a man turning into a woman and was getting her hormones, in order to start the transition. And the pharmacist refused. And so we talked about the legal aspects and the moral aspects of that. But then it got into, well, what do we think about transgender? I mean, I am sympathetic to Dr. Peikoff's view, but I'm not quite ready to take that position head on. And Dr. Peikoff's view is, this is a major psychological problem. It is a major, major psychological issue. The fact that they would go all the way to self-mutilation, to the point of mutilating themselves physically and with the hormones, I guess mutilate themselves in terms of the composition of the hormones relative to where they were born. It, you know, he views this as just complete insanity. And I'm very, very sympathetic to that view. I mean, there's something just wrong here. There's something just unnatural, certainly unnatural about it. But I also am sympathetic to the fact that even if it is a major psychological problem, it's a problem and people have to deal with it. I don't think it's a condition you're born with, although it's hard to tell exactly what we're born with and what we're not born with in terms of the how the hormones impact who and what we are and exactly what the relationship is between, you know, our genetic makeup, our hormones, the chemicals in our body and ideas and the impact of environment and the choices we make. And how all that interacts and what is it exactly that we're born with? What does our genes and our hormones impact? What effect do they have? They can't have effect on our ideas, but what effect do they have on what exactly do they have? I've talked about that with a little bit with Ankar and Greg in a previous show, and I don't have a clear answer. So my view is I feel, you know, I know I'm not supposed to say this, but I feel sorry for these people because obviously it's horrible to really feel like you don't belong in the body that you have, to really feel that you should be somebody completely different, to feel like you have to take these hormones to feel whole in some way. I doubt that they ever feel completely happy, that they ever feel completely whole. But they have a political right to do with their bodies as they see fit. And of course, Dr. Peikoff agrees with that. And if they want to go ahead and do these things, then so be it. So I would not stop them And as a pharmacist, I wouldn't not give them the drugs if that, you know, if they wanted. They're trying to, I guess, deal with the problem that they have to the best of their ability. I don't know that psychology, psychiatry has reached a point where we can analyze that again. And I don't think we have a proper understanding of what exactly is going on that causes people to feel this way. And as I said, I know somebody who's transgender, who transitioned from being a man to a woman. You know, they're a nice person. They're incredibly productive. I doubt they're particularly happy, but they, you know, hang out with them, and she, I guess, is really nice, and that's about all I have to say, because I don't know what more to say. Do you have any more specific questions, Jonathan? Or
and I don't want to. We can move on if this isn't interesting to you or the audience. But there was a video I saw kind of being tossed around about a program where essentially a drag queen came and gave a presentation in front of young people in schools about kind of what that was. And maybe I'd push you a little bit further and say, you know, you had. I remember you told a story once about, I think, environmentalism. I remember. And your children being taught environmentalism at school. So I throw it back to you and said, well, if drag queens, if transgendered ideas were being presented to your children, I think your boys in school, what would have been your response, and what should be parents' response in the schools right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think if it's a private school, if it's a public school, I don't have an answer to that, because it's impossible to answer what should a public school do. That's part of the reason I oppose public schools, is because they're in this impossible situation. They should do what the parents want, but the parents really have no voice. And you know, the parents can't take their kids out. They, you know, it's just anything they teach in a public school is distorted by that. In a private school, I think I talked about sex education in one of the shows. And I don't think that, I certainly don't think below a certain age, any of this should be talked about in a school. Below the age of 16, I think any of this is completely inappropriate to talk about, unless there's some specific issue, there's some kid in the class or something like that. It's just inappropriate for kids. They can't understand it. They can't comprehend it. I don't think anything in terms of sex, qua sex, should be discussed with kids below the age of 13, certainly, and probably below the age of 15, 16. They just don't have the tools. I mean, you could talk about reproduction. I think it's important for kids from an early age to understand reproduction, to not think that babies come from a stock or from God or from whatever, that they know the biology of that. But in terms of sex, I'm not sure schools should be talking about sex at all, other than to convey certain pieces of information. But in a private school, I would complain. Of course, in a private school, I would have the option to take my kids out of the school if I really didn't like it.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, all these things, I don't want teachers. I don't want there to be a teacher to talk about different sexual poses in school. I don't want them to talk about, you know, they can talk about protection and safe sex. That's fine. But beyond that, you know, I don't think it's appropriate. And I don't think in a proper educational curriculum, it's the responsibility of the parents to teach their kids about sex. It really is. And I think it's important for parents to teach their kids about sex. And I think they should do it at a reasonably young age, given how much exposure kids have to pornography today and to everything else online. And I think parents have to talk to their kids about transgender issues, because they're in the news, right? It's everywhere. And, you know, it's tricky. It's tricky and hard. And we know very little. anything else, Jonathan?
Yeah, I do. But if Jennifer wanted to jump in, I don't want to.
Okay, on a different topic? You going for a different topic?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to Jennifer. Do you have something, or should we keep with Jonathan?
No, I got something.
Okay, go with it.
Can you elaborate on this? Because I don't think I understand it as well as I should. The difference between loving a piece of art personally and knowing that it's actually great art.
Yeah, I mean, the standards are completely different. So I can hear a pop song from the 1970s and it evokes a particular emotion because it places me in a particular time and place as a kid, and it reminds me of certain things, and I like it. It puts me in a particular mood because it's associated with a particular state of mind that I was in when I was young. But so I can say I like it, but I can't say, is it good art or isn't it good art? For that, I would need to have some knowledge and some theory about music and about what's good music, what's bad music, how one evaluates good music versus bad music. And I don't. And it's very difficult to have that. I can broadly say that I think, and this is, but it's, I don't say this with certainty. I think that classical music is better than a pop song from the 1970s because it's more complex. The emotional response is deeper, more substantial, more. And I think that's true whether you like classical music or not. But you might say, you know what? Classical music doesn't do anything for me. I don't like it, but I recognize that, you know, people who know aesthetics and know music, that it's better, right? So does that make sense? Or, you know, I don't know. You can look at Dostoevsky, right? So I don't know any, you know, I don't like Dostoevsky. It doesn't give me, it's not fun to read Dostoevsky. I can enjoy it in some sense, but it's not my favorite. I prefer I prefer good swashbuckling adventure story from the 19th century on Dostoevsky. But Dostoevsky's a better writer. It's greater art in the sense of he's got clearer themes. The plot is brilliant. He's got these amazing characters, and the characters are amazing. But the questions he's asking, and you know, they're really important, but the answers he gives are wrong. And he's very dark and he's very depressing. You know, Breaking Bad is probably good television aesthetically. And even though I watched the entire frigging thing, I hated it. I can't say I enjoyed it. I can't say I liked it because there was not a single character in that show who was a good guy. They were all, to use a technical term, scumbags, all of them. And idiots, morally offensive human beings. And so that's my kind of, so my moral evaluation of it is it was bad. Aesthetically, it was beautifully written, beautifully filmed, amazingly acted, integrated. It had a clear theme. It had amazing character development. By every standard of which I would measure what great art is, I would say, I won't say it's great, but I would say it was good art. But I would also say it was horrible to watch. I mean, not horrible to watch. It was difficult to watch. I wouldn't say I enjoyed it. I wouldn't say I liked it. I'm not going to watch it again.
So is that that Goya painting of Saturn, like eating his kids or whatever?
Yeah.
Like that's, so you could say like it's a great painting, but you wouldn't want it on your wall in your house.
Yeah, I mean, I can say that to a lot of paintings. So, I don't know my evaluation of Goya qua, is that a great painting? But let's say there are magnificent paintings of crucifixions, just magnificent, right? I can think of Caravaggio, or there's a beautiful painting of Caravaggio's of Salome presenting the head of John the Baptist, right? She's just had it chopped off and it's on a tray and it's right there. I mean, it is a beautiful piece of art. And I, you know, when I'm in a museum, I'll spend some time looking at it because the way he uses light, the way he uses expression on the faces, the motion, the drama, the way he creates drama in a painting, All of that is magnificent and beautiful and striking. But I don't want a painting of a guy's chopped head on my wall. I mean, I have a painting on my wall, actually, of Judith. She's just chopped the head of her enemy off, but the head doesn't appear in the painting. And she's standing there with the sword, and she's just a strong woman who has taken on the world and done something nobody would have expected, and she's going to lead her people to victory. And she's just this amazingly strong, powerful woman. So I have that painting on the wall, but I wouldn't have it if she was holding up a tree. You see, the thing is with Salome, she didn't even do the chopping. John the Baptist was in prison, and she got one of the gods to do it. So she's not even a strong woman. She's a pathetic woman. But in the painting, it's dramatic, and it's beautiful, and it's presented well, and it's wow, right? So I say that's great art. Caravaggio is one of the greatest painters of all time. But I'm not tempted to put a Caravaggio on my wall, because what I get from it is great art. I get that experience of witnessing great art, which is an important experience. But what I don't get out of it is that sense of life, that energizing feeling that, yes, I want to start my day with that on the wall because it gets me excited and it gets me energized to take on the day, which great art should do for you. Art you love and which is great should do for you. So I'd say that is that. Those are the differences. I will travel far to go see a Caravaggio in a museum, but I wouldn't have it in my living room. And, you know, a lecture that I really, really think everybody should listen to is actually a lecture that came out of my confusion paper, because what I just explained to you was a confusion of mine, just like yours, Jennifer. And I asked, and I had to write a paper about it to Leonard Peikoff, and then Leonard actually gave a class on that, and then he delivered a lecture about the topic, and that is how great the benefit, something like the benefit of great but evil art, like Dostoevsky, like Tolstoy, like some Caravaggio, like maybe Goya, right? It's great art, and you get epistemological value because you get to see a world structured in a particular way, and logic presented to you in a particular concretization, and that's all good. But the theme is evil, and you don't want to put stuff on the wall that has an evil theme. Dostoevsky, the theme is evil, so I don't like it. Breaking Bad, well, the theme of Breaking Bad is good, but it doesn't take 7 seasons of over and over and over. You know, basically, the theme of Breaking Bad is the slippery slope in morality. That is, once you violate your moral code, once you set yourself up with a little bit of evil, you are destined to become completely evil. That is,
you're saying that once he made the choice and started doing it, essentially it was all, I don't know if you said downhill from there, but I remember it got boring from there. You had commented on this before.
Yes, once he made the choice to start producing the drugs, and then made another choice to engage in violence, which was inevitable because of the nature of the drug business, he had to engage in violence. His path was set. He had to die in the end. So the fact that they killed him off was an act, was consistent with the theme. Jesse should have died with him. So one of my great objections to Breaking Bad was that Jesse did not die, because he did the same thing. He kept violating his moral principles, and he should have paid the price for that. But the problem with the show is, okay, I get that. You can do that in one season. But to turn it into 5 seasons where we just saw the slippery slope and another slippery slope and another, you know, just, okay, we get it. We get it. It's kind of boring at that point. The only other aspect of the show after that was that, I don't know if everybody's seen Breaking Bad, but that you also saw now the impact his evil now had on all the innocent people in his life. So on his wife, on his kid, on his brother-in-law, who was a basically decent, good human being, right? They all suffer. So that's the other thing that the show shows, is how your moral breach doesn't just have an impact on you, but it has an impact on everything you love, on everybody you touch, on the entire world around you. So that's a good theme. It's a great theme for a story. It just took way too long to get that all done. And it was I found it painful to watch because of how, because you couldn't anchor with anybody, because you knew that all the good people there, to the extent they were good, were going to be crushed. And you were just waiting for them to be crushed. And it took sometimes forever for them to be crushed. And it was painful. So I found Breaking Bad painful to watch, even though I watched all of it, because it was good. It was well made. And I enjoy watching well made stuff. Right. But it had a good philosophical theme. The theme was actually a good philosophical theme and important one. But from talking to people who like Breaking Bad, none of them get that. People tell me they liked, what's his name? The so-called hero. Anybody remember his name? The teacher who becomes a drug dealer. They liked him. How can you like this guy? You can't like him. He's a bad, bad dude, right? And he's exactly what would happen to you if you, Walter White, if you started on that path, on that emo path. So, all right, let's see. Jonathan, you had something else, yeah?
I have a few, but I don't want to monopolize.
Well, keep going and Jennifer will jump in. So do it one at a time.
Do you think it's normal to fantasize about old girlfriends specifically? Why, or boyfriend in this case? And why
do you think it's okay to fantasize about old girlfriends you had?
No, not I. I'm saying in general. Why do you think it is specifically that one does that, or if they do?
Well, I think because you had a strong emotional connection, because they were your boyfriend, girlfriend. You had a strong relationship. You had strong feelings. You maybe had a powerful experience, whether sexual or otherwise, with that person. And they're part of your subconscious. They're part of who you are. They're part of your experiences. And I think remembering, in a sense, fantasizing in the form of, in a sense, reliving or recreating or remembering or taking that strong emotion and putting it in a new context, a new situation, I think is somewhat natural. Like, I think what our fantasies rely on, at least to some extent, is our memory and our experiences. So you have to fill in the blank of the person you're fantasizing about. You know, it's difficult to fantasize about a complete stranger, although that can work too sometimes, depends on the fantasy. But so I think what you latch onto is something familiar, yet something from your past, yet something that's not right now in the present, because you're fantasizing sits outside of your present relationship. It's somebody different than who you are with right now. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, you're asking me questions completely outside of my expertise and specialization.
Why don't you take the super chat? I have a bunch more, but you've got people sending you money here.
Well, I got one, so I'll take the super chat. Don't worry. I'm going to come back to you, Jonathan. Jennifer?
Do you think some people that don't understand the win-win situation in economics is because they watch a lot of sports and contests and things where somebody wins and somebody loses? I just had that idea the other day. Maybe they transfer to economics.
Well, I think there's a sense in which they do transfer economics, but maybe, you know, I don't want to get into speculation why people, I think some people obsess about sports, they're overly committed, but I'm a sports fan, so I like sports. I don't want to say anything too negative about sports, but I mean, my view is that people who view the world as a zero-sum game are people who are stuck at the perceptual level, people who are not really engaging their conceptual ability. They're not abstracting. They're not thinking. Fundamentally, they're not thinking. They are stuck at perception. So perception, you see the dollars go to one place and the stuff go to another place. And it's stuck. It's like Donald Trump, right? Cannot go after Donald Trump, right? He sees dollars go to China and goods come to the United States. And at best, he views that as a zero sum type thing because the dollars went. But at worst, he says he loves dollars, right? He's like obsessed with dollars, money. It's all about money, which is typical Donald Trump. Very concrete bound, I think very materialistic in his life. And the money went away. And the stuff is here, but the stuff, you know, it's stupid stuff. It's stuff we can produce ourselves. What's the big deal, right? But the money's special, right? And that's a negative sum game. So I think it's an indication of lack of thought, lack of conceptualization, lack of abstraction, lack of stepping back and saying, you know, what exactly happened here? So it's non-thinking. And WP on YouTube is doing exactly the same thing, right? Because he's not thinking. He says jobs go to China. Really? What's unemployment in the United States today? It's like full employment. We've never seen anything like it, right? And there are more jobs, there are more job ads than there are people. They're massive. There's 200,000 missing people in construction. They need and they can't find them because we've restricted unemployment. So wait, how did the jobs go to China? I mean, it's the same thing. How did jobs go to China when everybody in America is working? So what jobs went, right? And not only that, but most of the jobs in manufacturing went to machines. And yet, in spite of the machines, everybody in America is working. How did that happen? Maybe.
Join the meeting.
All right. Wow. That was loud in my earphones. I know you joined the meeting. I'll get to you in like in 2 minutes. So it's like if I'm paying less for the stuff I'm buying at Walmart because Walmart's importing it from China, then I have more money to save or to invest or to buy other stuff, which creates other jobs. And of course, what happens to dollars that go to China? They come back as investment in the United States. The actual, if you take into account the capital accounts deficit, we have a positive capital account. So net, it's zero because all the dollars flow back into the United States. And where did those dollars go? They go into investment, which do what? Create jobs. So jobs can't go to China. The only thing we can do is our government can destroy jobs by regulating and taxing, and we can destroy jobs. But look, we're almost at full employment. By the way, we're almost at full employment under Obama too. It's gotten better under Trump at about the slightly higher rate than Obama's, but not dramatically higher rate. And yeah, he cut taxes and he reduced regulations. That's the one good thing he did. So we have more jobs, but that's not because of trade, guys. Think. You got to use the conceptual. So I think it's just not thinking. And I think one of the real characteristics of Trump and his devoted following, I'm not talking about people who voted for him. I'm talking about the people who will justify every single thing he does and the people who refuse to accept this issue of tariffs, which is damn obvious, is that they're not thinking. You know, thinking is not easy. Thinking is hard. And a lot of people don't do it. All right, we're going to do one more question from Jonathan. Then we've got a caller, and then we'll do the super chat question.
Two questions I'd love you to quickly follow up on from previous podcasts, your own, if you could. One was about a bet you made with someone else about the direction of the euro. And you said at one point I could ask you about it, others could ask you about it, if you would follow up on that.
Sure.
And another was, and maybe this is, if this is kind of not for public disclosure, that's fine as well, but you had alluded to about a donor and an issue that had been lost or an issue with funding. And I don't know, again, if this is not for public disclosure.
Yeah, I'd rather not talk about that. I mean, I'll talk about it with you privately, but there's no.
What about the bet on the euro?
Yeah, so this is a bet on the euro. So this is when the euro was instituted. and it went into effect in the 90s. And an objectivist philosopher said, well, you know, that's it, right? Europe is going to tank. I think it was when it was issued, it was close to 1-to-1. And he was thinking the dollar was going to be so much more valuable than the euro within just a few years because the Europeans would just inflate like crazy. And I said, no. I mean, why do you think that the European Central Bank is going to be worse than the American Central Bank? And why do you think that European Central Bank, mostly controlled by Germany, I would expect actually to be better than the American Central Bank, controlled by Washington or Alan Greenspan. It was Alan Greenspan at the time. There's absolutely no reason to think that the euro would lose value relative to the dollar. And indeed, that's what happened. The euro actually gained value. So today, the euro sells for more than a dollar. It's more valuable, if you will, than $1. And it's primarily because the Germans don't want inflation. And Germany is obsessed with never having inflation. If you think about their mindset is the Weimar Republic had inflation that caused economic collapse, which led to the rise of Hitler. We never want to have the rise of Hitler. We are afraid of fascism. That's the thing that we fear more than anything else. And so therefore, we will do everything in our power to prevent price inflation from getting out of control like it did in the Weimar Republic. And as a consequence, they have prevented price inflation. So if anything, we've seen deflation in the European Union more than we have inflation, in terms of prices of goods, not in terms of the creation of money. So, that's the stories. And I think that continues. I don't see an inflationary threat in Europe right now. Much more likely that America will see inflation. I think we're far more lax about these things than they are. Price inflation. But at least as long as the Germans are really dominant within the central bank. And of course, maybe their control of the central bank is weakening. But there's no evidence to suggest that so far, at least. You know, they're doing a lot of this easing. But we've seen that the easing is not generating, the printing of money in the form of easing is not generating price inflation, because what the central bank tends to do is suck all the money they create out of the economy by requiring banks to hold larger reserves or paying interest on those reserves at the Fed in the United States and at the European Central Bank in Europe. So they've managed to, in spite of printing a lot of money, avoid price inflation. Also, because what you're really experiencing over the last almost 10 years is deflation. That is, prices would have gone down if not for the Fed printing money as they did and the European Central Bank printing money as they did. So, yeah, I see no reason to think that the people running the European Central Bank are more inflationary than the people running the Fed. That is the bet that I took. I think it was for an ice cream. I don't think I ever got paid. But anyway,
thank you.
All right, let's see. We've got a phone call. I'm not sure who this is. Hi.
Hi, you're Ron.
Yeah, hi.
It's Robbie. How you doing?
Hey, Robbie. How's it going?
I'm very well, very well. I wonder if I could just ask a question. Is it zero sum thinking to think that only one of two people could be the president of the United States? And I know, as much as you don't like to, you know, look over at, you know, what could have happened.
Yep.
And I don't want to put you in a situation where you're complimenting Donald Trump. But it was either Hillary or Donald.
Yep.
And in any situation today, is it zero-sum thinking to think, well, you know, what would have Hillary done in this situation? Because it was one or the other. We don't get the luxury of an objectivist president.
Yep. Yep.
It's one of the two.
It is zero-sum thinking, but it's appropriate to think in zero-sum here because it's one or the other. There's no, you know, it's either Hillary or Donald Trump. You can't have both and you can't have a third candidate. It's one of the two. The question, I mean, there are multiple questions. Given that it's one or the other, does that mean you have to vote for one or the other? And my view is no. You don't have to sanction either one of them. In a sense, you can protest that alternative. Somebody's ruffling papers. Maybe that's you, Robbie.
Well, that was me. I was just turning to the quote that moral neutrality necessitates a progressive sympathy for vice and a progressive antagonism to virtue.
It's not moral neutrality. It's not moral neutrality. I believe that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, in from a moral perspective, are both evil. So I'm not morally neutral about them at all.
And is there a continuum? Is there a continuum? Is one more evil than the other, or you put them exactly at the same point?
It could be, but moral neutrality would say that I'm not going to take a position on whether they are moral or not. And this is why I spent all my time condemning Donald Trump, because I do think he's evil. He might be less evil than Hillary, although I'm dubious. He might be less evil than Hillary, but it is moral neutrality to see something that is evil and not call it evil. So I will continue to call Donald Trump evil as long as I see him evil. So neutrality would say, I'm not going to take a position because he's better than Hillary Clinton, so I'm not going to take a position on his morality. That is what is the slippery slope that from the quote that you just cited. But that's not what I'm doing. I'm saying he won. He's president. What she would have done in every respect is irrelevant because she's not here right now.
It's irrelevant. How is that not relevant?
Because she lost. So she's not here. So there's no parallel universe where she is running the country. I'm not saying, and I haven't said, you guys should have voted for Hillary Clinton. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying Donald Trump is evil. He is doing horrible things to the country. He is very, very destructive to the country. That has to be said, and that's what I'm saying. So
the follow-up is, given what we know about Donald Trump, we don't know how Hillary would have been, but we know how Donald Trump is. Today, would you prefer that we have a President Donald Trump, or would you really just sort of long for a President Hillary Clinton?
I long for
which
neither.
One?
I basically...
No, you have to choose one.
I don't.
That's my whole question. Is it zero sum to say, no, you really... Given what you know, which do you choose?
Given what I know, I choose not to choose.
I'll leave it to your audience to see if that is moral neutrality.
That's not moral neutrality. Hillary Clinton's evil. I'm very clear morally about her. And Donald Trump is evil in my view, and I'm very clear about that. I'm making a moral statement about each one of them.
But you won't separate the two. You put them in the same bucket.
Ayn Rand said very explicitly, if two candidates are evil, one must not choose between them, because then you're sanctioning evil. And I'll find the quote for you, Robbie, if you want. But
No. I'm asking you what you say now. So I'm just asking what you say. Is there no difference between them?
There's no difference between them. There is a difference. I can't tell which one, but the difference is so minor that neither one of them would get my vote. Neither one of them would get my choice. Both are sending this country off in a horrible, disastrous direction, which I don't know that we can recover from. So I'm not going to support a candidate that is doing that to America, even if that candidate is mildly better than somebody else who would send the country in a direction it can't recover from.
I'm not suggesting you do support Donald Trump. I'm just suggesting that he is a better president than Hillary Clinton ever would have been. And given the circumstances.
I'm not convinced of that, Robbie. So I'll give you, and I'll tell you why. Because the question of what is a good president is not just a question of what policies they engage in right now. The question is, what are they setting the country up for? What is the future? I believe that a lot of the very negative trends that are happening today in our culture are a consequence of Donald Trump getting elected, including, I'm just seeing a lot of stories right now, the rise of this democratic socialism, which is gaining popularity around the United States. If it turns out, and I might be wrong, I certainly am not saying this in certainty. If it's true that a Donald Trump election is going to lead to a more vicious left and ultimately to a more vicious right and as a consequence in a generation from now, a much worse America than what Hillary would have done, because she probably would have just continued with Obama stuff and the right maybe have gotten it right as a consequence. I don't know. I don't know how to even measure those kind of things. All I know is this guy is bad for America. How bad? What are the long-term consequences? Would have Hillary been worse? All of that is speculation because the future is so difficult to predict.
Okay. well defended. I'm not sure that, I guess your audience will have to choose between a president, Hillary,
or President Donald. I'm not expecting anybody on an issue like voting. I don't expect anybody to accept what I say. On an issue of tariffs, I do. But the issue of voting, because tariffs is just this certainty. This is not a speculative issue. But on the issue of voting, I think it's a very complex question. It has a lot to do with how you view the future and how you view the long-term future and how you view each of their impacts on that long-term future. And I think there's valid, rational disagreement about whether not to vote for Trump or to vote for Hillary. I think that there are rational reasons for any one of those three positions. I don't think there's a rational argument for things like tariffs or certain actions that are being taken. But I don't think it's valid for disagreement there. But on voting is so hard and so complicated. I mean, Lena Peikoff and Ayn Rand disagreed about voting in 1980. She refused to vote for Ronald Reagan, and Lena Peikoff voted for Ronald Reagan. And I think those are the kind of disagreements that are going to occur many times in the objectivists, among rational people.
I'm sure there'd be disagreements if there was even an objectivist president.
Then it would be fun. Then it would be fun. The disagreements would be fun. These disagreements are no fun. They're just not fun. They're like talking, okay, who's more evil? And who would destroy the country slower? I mean, that's, ugh.
And the word evil for you doesn't conjure, you know, Donald Trump is pure evil. Well, not pure, but he is, he gets an evil category.
Yeah, he's an evader. I mean, what he did in Helsinki with Putin, that's just, ugh.
But if he's evil, then what's Mao Zedong and what's real evil?
They're more evil. I mean, there's no real evil. They're all evil. I mean, in objectivism, I mean, yes, they're gradations of evil. They're levels of evil. And certainly he's not
there a Mao. There are levels. Okay. So back to Donald and Hillary. Where are they in the levels? Because you wouldn't commit earlier.
I think that
there are levels.
I don't think there's a huge difference between them.
Really? Okay.
I know we disagree on that. I don't think
one is terribly corrupt. One is an accomplished, one was an accomplished businessman before he was so evil.
Well, I don't know. I never liked Donald Trump.
With an incredibly successful family and an incredibly successful career.
I don't consider them that successful. And the fact that Junior just got a divorce, I think is not surprising. I mean, yes, they wear nice suits and they're very pretty and they do the shtick really well. I'm not a huge fan.
Fact that Junior got a divorce is somehow not surprising. What has that got to do with that? Donald Trump's son?
No, because they have this they had during the whole election, they had this superficial facade to them, which I never bought. I never bought the idea that he had great kids. I mean, but that's fine. That's just me.
That's just the cynic in you, Euron. That is just the cynic in you. These kids could easily choose to step aside, not be part of the election, not be part of the family.
I would respect some kids for doing that, right? I respect that. Here, they so followed the party line. Even his daughter, who's a Democrat and who has a lot of influence in the White House, followed the party line. They would follow the party line. They did what their dad told them. I mean, I don't have a lot of respect for that. It just doesn't impress me. And his business career doesn't impress me. I'm sorry. It just doesn't impress me.
And you've walked into Trump Tower. You walked into one of his golf courses. Walked into one of his buildings.
Beautiful. All of that is beautiful.
Can you imagine, just in terms of construction, just take one property just by itself and walk into a building and ask yourself, what does that require? to put to erect a building like this, least of all that the properties that he's developed all over the world. Just one you're on, one property.
I know, but there
were, can you imagine what kind of mind that requires for you to so easily discount?
I'm not impressed with his business career. I know real estate developers who do amazing things. I know a lot. There are lots of real estate developers, and I'm not impressed with his career, given how he's managed his career, given his relationship with his lenders, given his given the fact that he inherited how much money he actually made off of the inherited money he got. Not that I'm against inherited money, of course, but how much
you'll throw that out there. Then why would you say that?
Because I don't think he made that much money. That is return on equity, which is how I view it, right? If you're a great businessman, you've created much more wealth than what you started with. It's about wealth creation.
And Donald Trump did not create more than his father did.
If you look at
good Lord, look around the world. Just look at the building.
I know.
Look at the building. I would love to walk with you on one of his golf courses, buildings, and just stop and have you reflect for just a moment in a lobby. What does that take?
I know, but that doesn't make you a great businessman. It makes you a beautiful builder and so on. That doesn't make you a great businessman. Great businessman, you measure by the amount of wealth they created. And if you take the amount he inherited and you randomly bought a set of properties in New York City at that time and you held it until today, would you be equally, not anybody who'd done it, I'm saying a diversified portfolio. Did you create wealth above that or didn't you? That's how I measure great wealth creators. That's how I measure them. That's my finance guy talking, right? Can you beat the index? Right? And if you can't beat the index, then you're not a great wealth creator. You might be a great builder.
You're saying you could have taken Donald Trump's father's money, put it just in a regular index, and made more of it than Donald made, he did with the portion that he inherited.
I think that's right.
He just didn't create billions.
I think that's right. So if you'd put it into New York real estate when he inherited the money and just sat on it, not built anything, just sat on the New York real estate for 40 years or whatever, 30 years or whatever the amount of time was, you would have had as much money as he has today. That's what now I can't prove that again. It's not with certainty, but I have a strong suspicion that's true.
I have a strong suspicion that your anti-Trump lens, is what fuels a comment like that, which I think would have to be so, I wish we had fact checkers like in the news. I'll bet you a dinner at any restaurant in the world that you're wrong.
We're on. I'll go and get the number. You're on. Thanks, Robbie.
Thank you, Ron.
Good call. Robbie's been... He challenges me every time we meet. So now he's done it live on the show, which is cool. All right, we've got a super chat question. Any comment on the EU Google $5 million antitrust fine? Should Google shrug and withdraw offering their service to the UN, to the EU? Certainly they should withdraw service from the UN. Wow, I mean, it's horrible. I mean, the fact that the EU has the power, that any government has the power, to inflict a fine like that on one of the most productive companies in the world, one of the companies that have changed all of our lives, that have in substantial, dramatic ways made the world in which we live better. The fact that any government agency can do that is just a massive injustice and horrible. And I don't care what they have to say about what they say about Google. I think this is about something about Android and bundling the apps in Android and stuff like that. It's just so corrupt and so horrible and evil and disgusting. And you know, the only thing is, it's good that the U.S. hasn't gone after Google yet, but it's just a matter of time before they do. I guess the Justice Department is too busy with Time Warner buying. What are they buying? Jonathan, remind me.
AT&T.
Time Warner.
AT&T.
No. AT&T buying Time Warner, right? They're too busy with that deal because who knows why they believe that is an antitrust violation. But this kind of fine is just so authoritarian and in nature, and it is really horrible. Should Google shrug? I mean, if Google shrugged, the world would change in dramatic ways. But if it shrugs there, then it's going to shrug in other places as well. It's going to have to shrug across the world. Now, it's already shrugged. For Google's credit, it shrugged basically in China. It would not play ball with the Chinese, and as a consequence, Google is banned in China, and it's given up a big chunk of the world. Could Google do the same thing in Europe? You know, you would have to look at the business case, but yes, morally, that would be amazing if they did it. But then to be successful at that, they would have to be consistent then in shrugging when the U.S. government went after them. And I think it's just a matter of time before the U.S. government goes after Google and Apple and Facebook. Facebook, you're already seeing the beginnings of that. And will they do it more consistently? And you know, it's a very difficult decision if you're a manager, particularly of a publicly traded company, because as a publicly traded company, your fiduciary responsibility is to shareholders. And how do you calculate whether paying the fine or shrugging is better for your shareholders? Now, we know long-term philosophically it's better for your shareholders, but they don't care. They're there for the money. And you have to do a financial calculating. So look, it's the whole idea of shrugging is a very, very, very difficult proposition. And think about the shrugging in Atlas Shrugged. When the businessmen shrug in Atlas Shrugged, they don't just shrug. They don't just stop working in Europe. They stop working. And they go to a valley and they have a life. And on top of that, they are working to ultimately change the world. So the whole goal is ultimately to come back into the world and change it. So just shrugging in one market without it being a moral shrug, without it being clear what your agenda is, without it being clear what the purpose is, that's a financial calculation. Now it's not a moral issue, because is Google in a position to come out and say, I'm shrugging because I will not sanction my destroyer? If Google could do that, then they should shrug, but I don't think they can. So it really should be a financial calculation, because they don't have the philosophical context to really shrug properly. There's a good lecture that Greg Salamieri gave about when to shrug. It's on the Ayn Rand Institute. I'm pretty sure it's on the Ayn Rand Institute channel, YouTube channel. Greg Salamieri, something shrug. I can't remember the exact name of the talk. Maybe somebody on the chat here knows what it is and can tell us. But I would recommend you go listen to that, because I think that'll have a lot more content about it. But I think if you're going to shrug, it has to be, you have to know why you're doing it, and you have to know what you're doing it for. And you have to, it can't just be, I don't like what the European Union is doing. If they'd only penalized me $1 billion, I wouldn't shrug, but $5 billion, that's over the top. No, it has to be a moral statement. And therefore you are willing to shrug no matter what the fine would be. But for it to be a moral statement, I don't think Google is in a position to make that kind of moral statement. All right, we've got another super chat here. What are your thoughts on psychiatric drugs? Leonard Peacock believed that they can be rational, but many objectivists believe you only rely on free will. I don't know any objectivist who believes you only rely on free will. Suddenly you can have psychological problems that involve chemical imbalances in your brain. And like being sick, just trying through thought, through cognition, to change that is often just not going to be enough. You're just not going to be able to, because there's something wrong. A circuit has broken, right? And therefore, certain chemicals are out of whack. And taking psychiatric drugs to get it back into balance is completely appropriate. Now, knowing when to do that, knowing when cognitive therapy is better, knowing how much to balance the drugs with the cognitive therapy if you've got a problem, that is not something I could talk about. That you would have to talk to a psychologist who is an expert on these things and knows this in detail. But I don't think there's anybody in objectivism who thinks you can will yourself to not have a serious psychological problem. or you can solve everything through cognitive therapy and drugs are never appropriate. I don't think Gina Golan suggested that. I think when I talked to her, she suggested there's a role for drugs. It's just that we overprescribe them because they're an easy solution today. And we just oversubscribe them to people without having any kind of, because in psychology today, there's no understanding of the role of free will. They just rely on drugs instead of balancing the two. And in some cases, drugs should not be given. I'm very critical of the idea of kids who are so-called, what do you call it?
Hyperactive.
Yeah, hyperactive, being diagnosed with some psychological thing and giving drugs. I think some of them probably require it, but my guess is very few. And we're way providing psychiatric drugs to people who probably don't need those psychiatric drugs. So my concern is the over-reliance on it rather than it has no role to play. I think it definitely has a role to play, but it has to be serious. It has to be a circuit broker, not just a cognitive issue. And sometimes it's hard to fix the cognitive issue. Let's say that something's wrong and you feel dread, you're clinically depressed. You cannot think because there's this emotional dread on you. And you cannot even use cognition because you just are so down on everything. Then giving you a drug that just clears your emotions up so now you can think and fix it, and then you can go off the drug. I just think physiologically, those are things that are valid and probably required. All right. If you want to ask a question, I'm getting a bunch of questions on YouTube. You got to use the super chat. Otherwise, I'm not going to take the questions. So if you want to ask a question, go to YouTube, use the super chat. Or if you're a Patreon supporter, $25 or above, you can call in. You got a number from me with a call. So feel free to do that. All right. Jonathan, do you have any more questions? And then go ahead. Or Jennifer, do you have any more questions?
Yeah, I was thinking the other day about, I know like in humans, emotions come from thoughts, and animals have emotions too. Like higher animals can have some somewhat complex emotions, but they're not from thoughts, they're just from percepts. So does that mean the emotions are fundamentally different or not really?
Well, I think there is a level of difference in the emotions, but I think that emotions come from conclusions we have come to. And I think some of our conclusions we come through are not from thought, are from perceptual experiences that have not been analyzed. So for example, a little child can be scared by a dog without even thinking about it. So that emotion of fear kicks in without really going through a process of thought. And it's not about conclusions they came to in the past. There's something about those snarling teeth and that barking and this thing that's bigger than you or almost as big as you coming at you that is scary. And so there are, the perceptions can trigger certain types of emotions. And, you know, that is the conclusion you're coming through. That is a dangerous thing. So I don't think emotions have to be generated from our conceptual knowledge. And in that sense, those kind of emotions are what animals have. They're at the perceptual level. It's a threat or it feels good. You know, you take a baby and you rub its tummy like softly and they feel pleasure, right? They're not conceptual yet, but they feel pleasure, right? Now that's not exactly an emotion, but that is can generate that perception of pleasure, generates a positive emotion that they're experiencing. I think that's right. You guys are challenging me today, asking me a question outside of my, Jonathan?
Yeah, sure, quickly, one final one, your own. First of all, I wanted to thank you and the staff of the Ayn Rand Institute for an amazing OCON, the biggest and best ever.
Oh, thanks.
It's really tremendous. And apropos of that, very quickly, for all the work you do bringing objectivism around the world, how many flight miles did you have in 2017? More or less to know. And thank you again for this today.
How many flight miles I had? Oh my God. I think it was 250,000. And I think that's right. Now, whether that's actual miles flown or whether that's the how American Airlines calculates it, and I've got some bonus miles in there or whatever, I don't know. But it was 250,000 miles, according to American, or something around there. A lot of miles. I fly a lot. This is weird. So my screens and my computer is basically frozen again. But I can still hear you guys. Say something, Jennifer.
Hello.
Yeah, I can still hear you guys, and I assume you can hear me. And I think my video is still projecting out. Nothing is coming in, though. So I'm going to figure out. I've got a new computer setup, which I thought would make my setup better, not worse. And yet it's made things worse somehow. So, and I don't know what's causing that. But, you know, we've gone over an hour. I'm going to take Doron's question here because he asked it on the super chat and it's frozen on my screen. And I'm going to take that and answer it. And then we're going to call it an afternoon. This is weird.
You're frozen on YouTube too, actually.
I am frozen on YouTube?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. The video is frozen?
It seems to be, yeah.
Do you know if they're getting sound on YouTube?
This is a good question.
Can you turn on the sound on YouTube?
Yes, they can still hear you.
They can hear me. Okay, good. All right, so I'll take this question and then... Since I can't see Super Chat and I can't see the video, maybe Jennifer, she has another question, then we can take that, but then we'll call it a day. All right, thoughts on people like Paris Hilton, Kylie Jenner's entrepreneurial success being devalued because they inherited money, but did they beat the index? Yeah, I mean, they beat the index. There's no question they beat the index. I don't know about Paris Hilton. Kylie Jenner, I think the whole thing, I think they definitely have beaten the index. I don't know about Paris Hilton, whether she beat an index. I don't see the value of an entrepreneurial activity if you're not creating wealth. And wealth creation means that you have outperformed not doing the activity that you did. If you start a company and the company doesn't perform as well as an index, then it's not a great achievement. It's not a huge success. It might be success because it's the best you can do, but it's not wealth creation. So it's incredible wealth creation. Now, I have to admit that I have very little respect for the wealth, quote, wealth creation that Paris Hilton and Kylie Jenner are engaged in, and they're so-called entrepreneurial activity. There's certain activities that while they create money, they make money. I would say their value is dubious. If you're a drug dealer and you're making money, even in a free society, you're selling people drugs that you know are harmful to them and you know are addictive. Yeah, you can make a lot of money, but I don't have much respect for you. If you're engaged in an industry that is pandering to the lowest common denominator and you as part of this industry are bringing a camera into your home so that a camera is following you day and night throughout everything that you're doing, I find all of that so despicable as behavior and so shallow and low that I have no respect for the people who do it. I mean, I think reality TV of that nature is beneath contempt. It is just, it's disgusting. It's disgusting to participate in it. And I don't understand anybody who watches it. I think it's sad that we live in a culture where Paris Hilton and Kylie Jenner, because they are, because they have cameras attached to themselves, have made money and are stars. Now, yeah, some people get values out of it, but they're completely irrational values. And it's, I just find it depressingly sad to live in a world where that is how people can make money.
You're on. I can't let you, I couldn't let you close the show on that sour note. So
no, I'm not closing the show yet, but okay. But go ahead, Robbie.
Well, I had a quick closing question. So
sure.
Should I go ahead and ask? Yeah.
Yep. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. 2020, Hillary decides to run again. Who are you taking?
I'm not voting. I will not vote between Hillary and Trump.
And who would you prefer? I don't have a preference. Terrible question. Who would you prefer to be president?
I do not have a preference.
No preference.
I think they're equally.
Political relativism.
No, it's
a failure to judge between the two. You can't discriminate between those two.
No, not in fundamental terms, not in long term, the long term future of this country. And, you know, and I'm here and, you know, this is Ayn Rand did the same thing. So, no, I
so what can't. Do you expect the American people to do if you can't?
I expect the American people to nominate better people. That's what I expect American people to do. The thing that is depressing to me is not that Donald Trump won. What's depressing to me is that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were the candidates. That to me says more about the American people than the fact that Donald or Hillary would have won. It's that we had that choice. That choice is so despicable that it depresses me about the state of the country. And you wanted me to end on a positive note.
Yeah, I was going to say, there you go again. It doesn't take you much.
It's reality TV mentality that brought us to the point where Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were the candidates for president of the United States. I mean, when I came to America as a young, you know, not so, I guess, young person, 31 years ago, I could have never imagined, as bad as politicians were back then, I could have never imagined that the choice would be between these two horrific candidates. So, you know, it's sad. It really is. Now, my point is about being optimistic about the future is what's great about America. And if you'll allow me, I'll try to end with this, Robbie, so we can end on a positive. What's great about America is that politicians can screw up in glorious ways. For example, Donald Trump is raising tariffs right now. But the response of the market is to raise the value of the dollar. And the reason that is the Chinese still want dollars to be able to buy American assets. So they're going out and they're buying dollars. Instead of selling us stuff, they're going to buy dollars. So the value of the dollar goes up. By the value of the dollar going up, Chinese goods become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So the tariffs become less and less significant. So the Chinese goods don't go up in price. So the Chinese still continue to export stuff to America. So we benefit from it. So the tariffs can go up, and yet there can be very little impact. Now, the dollar going up has other potentially negative consequences because it's going up artificially that way. But our economy and our people and our entrepreneurs and our inventors and our creators and our scientists and our productive business people primarily are incredibly, incredibly resilient. And they are resilient to the stupidity and the ignorance and the just sheer incompetence of our politicians. And that's why even if Hillary would be president today, we'd still be okay, just like we were okay, not great, not good even, but okay with Obama. And I think we'll be okay with Trump. We are incredibly resilient, particularly economically. Culturally, I'm not so sure. You know, one of the sad consequences is that the most productive people in the world we live in today, the people who are driving this economy forward, the people who are really making this economy function, live on the coasts. They're those horrible people that might have even voted for Hillary. And yet, in spite of that, they're productive, they're innovative, they're creative. And that's what I think America is about. America is not about this politician or that politician. It's not about this political agenda or that political agenda. Fundamentally, it's about people pursuing their happiness, people pursuing their own self-interest, creating, building, making, and enjoying life and embracing life. And as long as that continues, then politicians will slow that down. They'll make it harder. They'll make life more difficult. But at the end of the day, you know, we're incredibly resilient and we can overcome the evilness of all these stupid, dumb politicians. And I'm optimistic about the future because I think the politics doesn't dictate life. And there's still a lot of goodness, a lot of virtue in the American people. And I think that they will, whether it manifests itself in politics in 2 years or in 10 years or in 20 years, we'll overcome the things that the politicians throw at us. And at the end of the day, we'll be fine in 20 years. That's my hope and my prediction. All right, Robbie, thanks for joining us. Jennifer, thank you. Jonathan, thanks. Thank you, everybody on YouTube and on Facebook. I apologize that I have to cut it off here, but my super computer that set up that I created has bailed on me. So I will talk to you all. See you all probably tomorrow. I'm probably going to do a show tomorrow. I'm interviewing Paul, and I, you know, his family name just dropped out of my mind and I can't bring up his name because my Angelo, Paul Baird, he's fascinating because he's a lawyer who protects property rights. He fights on behalf of individuals against state intervention on primarily the issue of property rights. He will tell you about one of the most evil institutions that exists in the United States today, which is the California Coastal Commission, which is a little fascist organization that is just unbelievable. And Paul's a great guy, a lawyer who fights for individual rights, there's a case right now that he's involved in that he's trying to take to the Supreme Court, which I think is a really, really important case. And so we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court. We're going to talk about property rights. We're going to talk about the various legal issues confronting Americans today where their rights are being violated and how Paul and others, and for example, the Pacifica Legal Foundation, which he used to work for, Institute for Justice, which does as a similar mandate, do in order to try to fight the violations of rights. All right. You've been listening to Iran Book Show. We'll be talking to Paul Baird tomorrow. We've also got a show going on Tuesday night, and we're going to keep you busy. Look forward to talking to you all. And by then, I hope to have fixed this computer and figured out what the hell is going on. Bye, everybody.
Thank you, Iran.
See you later. Bye.